Welcome to the Exalt Podcast. My name is Christopher Chagnon.
And I'm Sophia Hagalani-Albov. We are intensely excited because we are in store for a really, really good conversation. Not to put too much pressure on it. Coming for his third turn on the Exalt Podcast, we are super delighted to welcome Xander Dunlap. I don't want to waste too much time in introduction. So Xander, would you like to say hello to our listening audience and remind them who you are and what you do?
Yes. Hi, everybody. Third time I've been here. I'm Xander, or Alexander Dunlap. I'm a research fellow at the Institute for Global Sustainability at Boston University, also a visiting research fellow at the Global Development Studies Department, University of Helsinki. And I think what we'll be talking about today is ultimately a book that's kind of reviewing the last 10 years of my work on energy infrastructure and mines. And I'm in the middle of a big project right now looking at solar panel supply chains from operation, extraction, manufacturing, and decommissioning. So happy to be here.
Welcome, Xander. It's always a pleasure. I mean, now I think you went from friend of the podcast to best friend of the podcast. I don't know. You might have already been best friend of the podcast, but BFF of the podcast then. Truly the top of the pyramid, the most prestigious position. So just for everyone listening, Xander was kind enough to share with us the first chapter of his new book, The System is Killing Us, Land Grabbing, the Green Economy, and Ecological Conflict. Now, I mean, I know I've really enjoyed getting this taste of it, but Xander, would you mind kind of telling us a little bit kind of generally about the book?
Yeah, I'd love to. Thanks for having me. And you know that the Exalt Podcast is also my favorite podcast, so it warms my heart to be a BFF of the Exalt Podcast. And everyone knows that I am a big fan of the Exalt Initiative in general and what it hosts and the different kind of facets it has. But yeah, super happy. Thanks for letting me come talk about this book. But yeah, this book, like I said, is pretty much 10 years of working environmental conflicts. I think a lot of it comes from being rather dissatisfied of what's coming out of like the popular left or popular academic kind of publishing circuits in terms of where the conversation is at in terms of talking about ecological crisis and catastrophe. This also relates to kind of the emergence of the climate justice movement, and it's kind of clashing with even and ignoring kind of existing autonomous land struggles. And yeah, one of the chapters talks about actually how that came about, especially with the politics of attack and occupation and fighting different mines. Specifically, it's the Humboldt Forest chapter. But so yeah, the book really comes as like a 10-year reflection of my work, and I'm really trying to kind of chime in and kind of speak to these popular academic or left debates.
So the title of the book is really evocative. This system is killing us. What do you mean? What's the system? Could you break this down a little bit for us?
Yeah, I'd love to. I'm going to be honest with y'all. This title was kind of a quick off-the-cuff proposal pick when I sent it in, and they really liked it. Because for me, I was like, what would actually describe my concerns and the way I feel and things like this? And it was like, this system's killing us. Ah! And then obviously when it's like, it's one of these obnoxiously vague phrases, but it's like, obviously I'm referring to capitalism. But more so, and I think more importantly, I'm referring to industrial systems. I'm referring to the state. I'm referring to modernity and really the depths of the kind of different types of infrastructures that maintains and kind of keeps, whether it's free market or liberal capitalism going, or whether it's a kind of a command economy, kind of state capitalism. But if I'm going to be honest with you, the book, I really wanted it to be titled something else. And the book's actually really designed around the concept of permanent ecological conflict. And that's actually what I wanted the book title to be, is permanent ecological conflict. And I'll tell you a little bit about that, because ultimately it's a play on Alfredo and Bonanno, rest in peace. They recently passed away. They lived a long life and an extremely rebellious life. They were an anarchist theorist, probably one of the best amongst them. I mean, he was caught robbing banks when he was 73 years old in Greece. So that's impressive, not to mention the numerous stints in prison and ultimately writing a pamphlet in 1977 called Armed Joy, where they were put in prison for it, and this text in Italy. And I think they're rather important texts. But Alfredo, among so many others, amongst this kind of anarchist tendency, amongst anarchists, was this idea of permanent conflict. And the idea of permanent conflict is really a criticism and a rejection of activism. It's a rejection of this kind of nonprofit industrial complex, feel-good protests, kind of mainstreaming of things. And it's actually really being committed to struggle in the sense of living in permanent conflict against the structures that you see as oppressing you and oppressing others. And this means really, you know, this means self-organizing. So organizing your own affairs, doing it this way, So really being skeptical and keeping politicians at an extreme distance or using them in particular type of ways, that is not going to put you at a disadvantage, because usually politicians, their whole goal is to usually kind of take over and to kind of build their political status off of the backs of social movements. You know, thinking of the pink tide countries in Latin America or literally everywhere, the examples are countless. But the idea is to be self-organized, kind of do it yourself. This means engaging in unmediated action. So that also means having direct action. There's a couple other features to it, and it's worth kind of getting into for those who are unfamiliar with this. But the idea of the book is to really say, like, yeah, permanent ecological conflict. And it's just to kind of stress this kind of application, the importance of kind of ecological crisis, which has become rather popular and mainstream here since 2017. And actually really stressing the importance of permanent ecological crisis. Yeah, the system's killing us. The socio-ecological catastrophe is severe. And it's time to actually maybe start thinking a bit more seriously about this and to kind of surpass these token forms of activism and feel good activities, which I think academics, even myself included at this point, is, yeah, it's pretty much what we do. And it's a bit embarrassing, but hopefully this is an effort to kind of spread and to push to actually think past kind of the existing frameworks and modalities that people have been working in.
Thank you so much. And I mean, I think that that's such an amazing point and insight about, yeah, the mainstreaming of even environmental catastrophe and how, I mean, yeah, it's there, it's impactful somewhat, but it's kind of gotten so mainstream that it's kind of lost its punch. I'm curious, like with this like permanent ecological conflict, like how have you been seeing this play out? If you wouldn't mind giving us like a little like kind of peek into some of the aspects in the book.
Yeah, so I mean, that's like the real kind of thread, whether theoretical or practical, that kind of goes through the book is this idea of permanent ecological conflict. So yeah, maybe to give an overview of the book, besides kind of giving a prologue and showing the horrors that I've kind of confronted and dealt with on field work and the introduction of kind of framing things and talking about degrowth and, you know, the Green New Deal and ecological authoritarians and things like this and the problems with it and how this book is an intervention against it. The first chapter is called The Science of Maintaining Socio-Ecological Catastrophe. That's actually delving and looking into kind of this ideas of carbon, energy, and biodiversity, and really the metrics that are used to even kind of assess and talk about this conflict and how the problem begins there in terms of our relationship and the way that even science speaks and relates to these things. And when I say these things, literally like ecological degradation or social control and oppression against people and how this is kind of conceived or not conceived or ignored and bypassed through different kind of modeling or data collection that ignores these things. That aspect, the chapter one in terms of permanent ecological conflict, really looks at the kind of the social war of science and the different kind of frameworks and the ways that people look at the world. And really the idea of social war, which is kind of talked about in the introduction, is intimately tied to this idea of permanent ecological conflict. I mean, social war ultimately, in one sense, it's a theory and also an attack. It's a modality that ultimately anarchists have talked about for a long time in terms of how they actually assess and understand kind of states and systems in terms of how they intervene into the social relationships and fabrics of people, of which science is instrumentally important in the whole, you know, schools, universities, and the ways they do things. So this idea of social war and social war theory is really important to this. And I can talk more about that if you want. But so the first chapter really looks at this in terms of this framing of this kind of intervention of our mentalities and how problems are being framed and how this is the problem. And then I look at chapters two. I go back to, yeah, I guess this was in 2015. I guess I was in Oaxaca from 2015 and would go back. I haven't been there since 2020. And I really look at the problem of wind energy development in the area. And I already have a separate book about this, but this is kind of a summary reflection on more stuff. I might have even included some numbers with different kind of like stats in there. But it's a reflection on that. In that area, I joined a lightly armed police communitaria and was in some pretty combative and kind of horrible situations there. So chapter one is looking at the way Zapotec and Akut people and also other anarchists and kind of autonomous people were kind of fighting in a pretty serious way against wind energy infrastructure and the politicians forcing it through. The second is the Hamburg forest struggle, which I worked on with my good friend Andrea Brock, who actually did a lot more in the area than I did and did their whole doctoral thesis on stuff related to it. But I go and kind of reflect on the Hamburg forest struggle against the lignite coal mine, which is a super impressive struggle. And while people talk about it to a degree and you hear a lot about the kind of Ende Gelände and a lot of these kind of weekend warrior kind of climate camps and nonviolent direct actions, which are really important, obviously, it somehow manages, and there had been internal debates in 2015, 16, 17, the serious and extensive levels of kind of militant direct action in the areas, and like, and really perfect example of kind of engaging in permanent ecological conflict in terms of the levels of kind of living in place, living with the forest to protect it, and protecting it in terms of engaging in numerous and repeated acts of sabotage and skirmishes with security and putting constant pressure on the mine. And this obviously went with all sorts of other different types of actions from different people and sectors, from NGOs to End of Galinda and a lot of things like that. But the latter two get a lot more attention and are forgetting actually the really kind of serious struggle there. And then the fourth looks at a copper mine in the Valle de Tambo in Peru, which was really interesting because it was a copper, it was by Grupo Mexico, or Southern Copper Peru, but Grupo Mexico was the main subsidiary, a Mexican mining company. So they owned wind turbines in Oaxaca, in the area I worked, and then they were doing a copper mine and have a lot of concessions in Southwest Peru. And so this was really interesting, like, oh, you need at least 3 tons of copper on average for one wind turbine. So I thought this connection was very interesting. And this area was an extremely violent situation where people are fighting, making barricades. And the fight still goes on in this area and has been successful at holding off this mine for 15 years now. But it has come with at least 8 deaths, hundreds and hundreds of wounding, families and things being kind of torn apart. But again, another example of people engaging in permanent ecological conflict. And for the most part, at least systematically winning battles and trying to keep this mine out. And then unfortunately, as we all know, fights against infrastructure and mines is something that is a generational struggle, which is in and of itself is sad, but it's also something to take pride in, to kind of protect the water, to protect the land, and protect the different cultural fabrics in those areas. And that is to engage in permanent ecological conflict against these things. And then number five looks at this kind of larger project where I was looking at the connection. It skips over some of it a bit quickly, but it looked at a zone de fond, so a zone to defend in southern France that was fighting a big energy transformer, La Massade. And so it begins there and kind of with that struggle, but it was part of a larger project that was looking at how that transformer not only was affecting things locally with the proliferation of wind and solar in the area when the area was already kind of energy autonomous with hydroelectric dams, but then also how this was actually connecting to an energy highway and how this was really about kind of capitalist markets, buying and selling and trading electricity and ultimately encouraging energy demand with this kind of encouraging high consumption urban lifestyles. But so I followed the high voltage power line to numerous different land struggles and conflicts, other ZADs in France. Struggles have been going on since 2004 in Catalonia, the no high tension power line struggle, and then also how that struggle goes to other parts of France. And then that research was done during COVID and it got cut off and I was trying to actually connect it, because there is a line connection between Morocco and the Western Sahara and this kind of energy highway. But in terms of the specifics of kind of buying and trading, and there is buying and trading going on, but whether it's coming specifically from the wind parks in the Western Sahara is to be determined. And then the final main kind of chapter is looking at the open pit lithium mine in Portugal. And this place isn't necessarily engaging in permanent ecological conflict, but there's signs of interest in it and potential for it. And there are farmers who are living in a committed way, trying to fight against this through the different institutions and legal pathways, and very open to direct action. And there have been many direct actions taken, but so it's whether it kind of continues this path and can develop into a permanent ecological conflict is to be seen. But so, yeah, there's a long-winded kind of overview of the book and how that's kind of the guiding thread throughout the book. And the conclusion obviously reflects on all these different struggles and what are things to kind of look out for and prepare for if you are in a land struggle, fighting to defend the forest, the rivers, the mountains, the minerals, whatever you want to call it.
I mean, we've only gotten to read the introduction so far, but I'm really looking forward to actually getting into the whole book. And I don't know if Christopher has beaten me to it, but I'm definitely going to put in a request that our library gets it, because I think this sounds really interesting. And you go so many different places, but this red thread that goes through it is really fascinating, that people are engaged in this permanent ecological struggle. It's very interesting that you've gone to so many different contexts and so many different manifestations of the industrial modern system, and that you're seeing some of the same things happening on the ground. But before you told us a little bit more about the book, you'd brought up social war and you said that you could get more into that if we wanted. And I want it. Get more into it. Tell me more.
Yeah. I mean, so one of the things that kind of guides the book is that, I mean, there's a lot of mines and infrastructure projects going on all the time, and people go with it. They believe the marketing. they comply or they get paid off well enough, or they feel it represents them and their nation enough where they don't feel like they have to revolt or they don't have that kind of connection to the land. So there's plenty of mine and infrastructure. And most of all, people know it's connected to their cars, their computers, and they can identify with that. You know, the main thread in this book is that all these places and why I was there is because people had it. They're saying, this, they're not buying it. Usually there are people at the margins of society, either they're kind of local or national or global in terms of like energy consumption, even engaging with these more kind of extractive systems. And so that's what even kind of led me to a lot of these places in the first place. And so that kind of leads to this kind of aspect of social war. And this really, I guess this goes to a kind of a conversation about the state in a way. And I'll be giving some lectures next week. One of them will be with the decolonial group in Berlin. But one of the things is just kind of like, especially when we talk about things like decolonization, is like, how do you actually relate to governance structures? Do you see the state as a permanent occupation against your life? Or do you identify with it? Do you feel democratically elected and represented? And all this kind of horrible stuff being done, whether to nature, whether to people, whether to rivers, forests, you name it. Like, is this done because a democratic process that you voted and you read on and you say it represents you and your best interests? Or you don't agree with it, but it went through a process that you agree with, you know? So it really comes down to like how people actually relate to the state or the colony. And so this idea of social war is ultimately that the state and these kind of governing authorities don't represent your best interests. And it's actually a war to actually control and manage and to domesticate you. So that is that ultimately the state is actually a weapon being used against you. And it's trying to change your social relationships. Social war is actually an anti-colonial theory in terms of actually how you understand the existence of states, institutions, and the management of populations to adhere or to comply to these governing authorities, and ultimately how you get people to go work into factories or to go join war efforts, go fight wars in different imperial ventures, and so on and so forth. And the answer is that social war also can become, so like I said before, it's in one way a theory, and it's ultimately a theory of acknowledging and seeing the types of counterinsurrectionary and population control efforts that are being done by the states and different governing authorities. In another sense, it's also antagonistic. I mean, it's not only seeing it, but it's also from an anarchist perspective, fighting it and recognizing yourself almost as a prisoner of war and things that would often just be called crime or are designated that way. And so as my reference to crime, academically speaking, you know, someone who actually really brought up the discourse of social war was Michel Foucault. And in his kind of genealogy of politics as a continuation of war by other means, was him actually bringing up the theory of social war, though not directly. And it's really his work in Discipline and Punish, really looking at the birth of the history of prisons and actually the construction of society in terms of actually replicating kind of a military and utilitarian model. And also looking at specifically the prisons of Bentham in terms of how they were trying to economize repression and to make it easier to manage. You know, this really kind of underlines this idea of social war, which in one sense is almost synonymous with counterinsurgency in terms of its application against people. And like with any, I guess like Patrick Wolf, with talking about kind of the non-deterministic phases of kind of colonization or colonialism, you have ultimately your conquest, which is pretty much terrorism and genocide and a combination of the two, mass killing, to actually kind of completely tear apart bonds, traumatize people. Then you have their internment, and that means putting them into some type of reservation system, some more fortified than others. And then at a certain point, trying to assimilate them into the different kind of dominant political economy or dominant culture. And I added onto this with my work, you know, kind of a self-management phase, that this assimilation becomes so intense that you internalize and believe these things. And so the idea of social war is actually recognizing this process. But it's really subjective in terms of actually how you identify and how you relate to systems. If you believe in the nation and democracy and what it's doing to the planet and to the people on it, and when I say people, also animals, different creatures, then if you believe in that, then like, okay, this is democracy, not social war, you know? But then if you see this as like, hey, this is completely disastrous. I don't like how I've never been able to choose anything in my life. I've been institutionalized. You know, my fate has just been slowly organized to either join a war effort, a factory, or the workforce. Like, this is not how life's meant to be lived. Then this is kind of where that's coming from. But yeah, I guess some way to sum it up is social war is just really the way that there's various interventions into people's social relationships. And sometimes those interventions are, you'll see ultimately genocidal campaigns like you're seeing in Gaza right now. They could be riot police, assassinations, and this kind of overt kind of conventional war. And, you know, with counterinsurgency, there's been kind of this kind of scorched earth approach. But then there's also the kind of the more liberal, enlightened, and maybe even more insidious in terms of there's different soft social democratic approaches of participation, empowerment, sustainability that are kind of used to actually control and manage people in this way.
Thank you so much. This is such an amazing lens to view these relations and the world. And, you know, something that I kind of would like to ask about, you touched on a bit, but you definitely get into with like the introduction, is so how does this interact with what we're seeing now kind of in the politics of the North in terms of like these sort of green new deals, green deals, and these sorts of struggles?
Yeah, no, thank you. I mean, this is the thing is, and kind of what I'm getting at before is that there's a couple ways you can look at this. You can go back very far to, at the very least, the industrialization period where you had so many people being like, this is not good. And you had all the accounts of how England just is like a bellow of smoke. Then you can take it to Rachel Carson in the 1960s, who was like, this is insane, the way that DDT and all these different dioxins and poisons are spreading throughout the planet, which really helped kind of boost the environmental movement and begin that. And we saw, at least in the United States, for example, and other parts of the world, you saw some of the strongest environmental legislation in 1969 and the early 70s. And it's around this same time you see, you know, limits to growth, this rise of kind of like of formal degrowth thinking in kind of public policy circles, even though this has been around for centuries and has been an implicit understanding about the world before it became kind of this academic label. And so at that point, you're starting to witness hydrocarbon companies suppress this information, suppress this science, extremely well aware of it, funding the studies, but also suppressing it. I don't think carbon's a good enough metric. I think carbon is actually a completely manipulative metric in terms of how we're understanding ecological crisis. I think the kind of this idea of the means of reduction, you know, climate reductionism in terms of actually only looking at the climate and not looking at other things. And climate tunnel vision has been another thing that's been called. I think these are really important things to look at. But even by those own metrics, you see the graph of it just going, the carbon's rising, these rise, you have this talk about energy transition, yet there's no transition. It's just additions in terms of the expansion of nuclear and other kind of energy mixes, if you look at the different charts. So in terms of talking about social war, it's like, all right, there's been a million chances to actually maybe reflect on how we're relating, seeing and understanding the habitats that we live in, the environments that we live in. And that's not happening. And this in and of itself, the way we're taught to train, the way we're taught to live, the way we're taught to see the world. And I think Peter Gelbelus, but also Gustavo Esteva have been super good at just talking about this idea. I would call it like a biopolitical gaze to be academic jargony about it. But this way of how we're like, we're constantly disembodied from where we're living in terms of where we are, how we think, how we even perceive things. We're constantly always looking down at the world like we're planners to control it. I think academics are the worst in this. You know, it's like a lot of the times we're not even putting ourselves in those places, but we're thinking about how we can control or make some new policy or socially engineer some new thing. And this mentality, this way of seeing the world in and of itself is a perfect example of a kind of a psychosocial attack on people's minds in terms of how we're actually relating to our environments and looking at the world. And I think Peter also, it's quoted in the book, he talks about this, even the society nature dualism, you know, that humans are separate from nature, like this in of itself, this Western thought, this Cartesianism or this dichotomy that separates humans from nature in and of itself is a product of an illness, you could even say, but is ultimately this social war in terms of how our psychologies and our social relationships are manufactured in terms of how we're perceiving ourselves, how we're looking at our environment, and then what we're creating. And in earlier works, I mean, this is the thing. You're always going to have some type of colonization in terms of how people are relating to their environments, in terms of how you're actually sculpting. So, for example, the Amazon, there's in political ecology, there was always this kind of idea of pristine nature, right? Always pristine nature in the U.S. and other parts of the world. This was ultimately used to continue a genocidal agenda of actually clearing different kind of indigenous peoples out of different forests and different areas, you know, and I'm thinking of California and how that was done there. But that's the thing is that humans have always been a part of nature. Humans have always helped colonize their environments. And sometimes that colonization created beautiful, beautiful food-bearing ecologies, beautiful and rich forests with certain levels of harmony, yeah? But if what you're making is forever poison, you know, the dioxins, the way plastics are going into things, the way that ultimately we're looking at insane levels of catastrophe, of disaster, of poisoning, of contamination that are truly and utterly frightening. I feel like what's happening can only be relatable through like a horror film in terms of really how we're produced. Like when I say we, I don't identify with this, even though I'm entangled in it, but we're watching modern industrial humans produce and engage with completely toxic industries, producing things that will never go away, that are poisoning things. You know, the amount of lead and dioxins in humans or in different animals, rates of cancer that are happening is frightening, and it's coming from very obvious places, and it's coming from this type of industry, it's coming from this type of relationship with the land and this type of development that of course is aiming towards convenience, it's aiming towards speed, it's aiming for the kind of technologies we have with us, and they're no doubt enchanting, but they're coming at a cost that I don't think any of us should want to pay, even if I think a lot of people are and are paying for those things right now in that way and are willing to, but I would argue that no, we really have to kind of reflect on the type of technologies and the social structures and the infrastructures that we're living in and what they're doing to the planet and change this immediately. But this is just to say that how this happens is through a process of social war. It is through a process of colonization and conditioning that is actually breaking people down, their social fabrics, their relationships, and destroying the knowledges that are often closer to listening and being with the different kind of ecosystems and habitats there. And this is well documented, especially with the rise of mechanical science. And I think a lot of the feminist literature, specifically Vandana Shiva, Carolyn Merchant, and even better after, who have actually really shown the way that kind of science had to kind of exterminate and subjugate women and also poor people who were upholding these traditions in Europe. But we watched this tradition happen in Europe and we have it exported through colonization or classical colonialism elsewhere. And since then, we've only watched this morph through this kind of implantation of state systems and neocolonial ventures. But it's still happening. It's still continuing and it morphs. And we can look to the environment to see the kind of byproducts of this and what's happening, even if people are being born into it and maybe don't know any better at this point.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that pulling out this point, in the book, do you tackle it all? Like, how do people deal with this cognitive dissonance? How can we be in the system, but not of the system? You mentioned that in the last bit that you were saying that like you're entangled in it, but not of it. So what does that mean a little bit more? Could you break into that for us?
Yeah, no, I'd love to. I think that's a truly important point. For me, I think academically, some of the people that have been really good about pulling this out is the post-development school who really in the 80s and 90s and today, even if it's kind of been displaced by kind of talk about decolonial, I think there's a lot of issues with kind of the decolonial academics, especially in terms of their separation from more combative struggles and more so how they talk about them. But this is really key. I mean, the first step is really about how you identify with these things. Like I was saying before, if you completely relate and are like, yeah, this ecosystem destruction is completely acceptable so I can have my computer and so I can have this lifestyle checking 1,000 emails a day or playing video games, then it's like, all right, then we don't, like, here you go. You're for it. You're for this kind of level of technological progress, despite the idea, definitional idea of progress being extremely questionable in it. It's like there's not much to talk about. But for me, and I mean, this is kind of what I talk about in like the introduction of the book, is that I'm entangled in this. I watch all sorts of cartoons. I give some examples in the book. But I also know that we got to get away from this. I know that we got to get away from this, not only for myself and how this is very negative for my health, specifically my academic lifestyle and what it does, and also the way that universities have been restructured to speed you up to produce more. I mean, I've never had a tenure track contract, you know, the way everything is completely precarious, right? So it's like, not only my life, is this lifestyle with all these great technologies of flying on airplanes and Zoom and boop, 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 and television entertainment, flash, chemical releases in your brain, the smartphone, you know, okay, I do it. I'm addicted to it. I'm also asking for help in a lot of ways with it, you know, and I do a lot of things for myself with this, but I also know this is not the way. I know that the top and what's kind of projected as the top to be fully developed or overdeveloped is not the way. It is not a good direction. And I say from this, from living in ditches to to being on the top. And it's a very hollow. It hurts. And I mean, besides the rise of inflammatory diseases, and I can't stress the book Inflamed by Rupa Myra and Raj Patel, such an amazing book in terms of actually talking about the rise of inflammation and the different diseases in terms of, you know, diabetes, stress, you know, and it gets worse, autoimmune diseases, in terms of the way that with this kind of progress and modernization is being severe kind of health issues. And I feel these in my own life. And I think everyone does to a degree. And if we don't, it's because we've been able to kind of numb ourselves from them and ignore them, but they grow. And this is, I think, where a lot of other more terminal diseases come from, in addition to environmental factors and emotional factors. But so I think it's first about recognizing the problem, that like, this isn't okay. And that we have to stop development this way. We can't conceptualize progress this way. We can't fetishize economic growth. And this is the value of degrowth in terms of talking about these things and kind of raising this in a more kind of public way, despite other types of criticisms. But yeah, this is really to say it's important to disassociate, to change, to recognize that you aren't represented, your values aren't being cared for. These things that matter most in terms of, you know, political organization, integration of different technologies into your lives, whether it's biotechnology, whether it's digital online interfaces to manage students or submit journals, but really, more importantly, biotechnologies, artificial intelligence, like, these are not on the political menu to talk about. There is no real discussion about these things, the things that really matter. Ultimately, these kind of horrible processes aren't on the table. I mean, look what we're witnessing right now in Gaza. We're witnessing full-blown genocidal process continuing hardcore, and the European Union is just dancing around being quiet, and you're watching people be repressed for even talking about it. This is madness. So this is to say the first step is to disassociate, to understand it's a problem. And I think it's really, really important for academics to really critically reflect on their lifestyles, to critically reflect on what they're doing, how they live, and what they make, and how they're actually complicit in this type of destruction. And to, at the very, 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 very least, speak out against it. And I think this is really important. And I think one of the scariest things I've seen from every type of critical scholar, you're often not anarchists in fairness, but from a lot of critical scholars, is that they talk about being academics like the end all be all. And a lot of it is through this kind of horrible disciplinary process that's horribly competitive and people stepping on each other, doing horrible things to each other. But it's like, there's always becomes this discourse of like, they made it, it's where they want to be, it's the right place to be, and everyone else, oh, we got to look after them, we got to help them and rise them up, and so they can be academics like us, or be middle class or something like this, even though I think most academics aren't even middle class at this point in terms of how they're paid and how it works, you know, it's like, so working poor. But there becomes this horribly paternalistic kind of developmental missionary kind of narrative that I see coming out of who are supposed to be on the forefront, people employing some of the most critical discourses. And it's true, we're not living in a high intensity conventional war zone. Respect, like, great, that's awesome, you know, and that's something to value and never take for granted. But that doesn't mean we should roll over to the different types of kind of structural violence, infrastructural violence, symbolic violence, is epistemic violence that it pervades and reinforces ultimately imperial and colonial war ventures, internal, external, sideways, left, right, north, right, everywhere, you know? So yeah, I think this is a fundamental point, is that, and how the book starts is that, like, hey, this isn't trying to be on a high horse. Like, I'm in these things, I've got addictions to these things, but I'm identifying these as a problem. This has to stop. And this is a structural problem in terms of the way technologies and political organizations being put on us, and let's stop it. And I think academics have a huge responsibility to do this, and are some of the people being hit super hard with this kind of crazy overdevelopment and kind of precarious and just being hit with insane, literally all the good things about academia are being used against people to actually make them work harder and faster.
Absolutely. And that was something I really appreciated reading through the introduction, that you pointed that out, that you yourself are in this system, that you yourself enjoy these things. I mean, I do too. I'm totally addicted. And of course, my research is all about, you know, the harms of technology and things like that, but I'm definitely addicted to tech.
Oh yeah, me too. Like, completely. Truer words never spoken. It's sick, but it's true.
But one of the things I also find so interesting about this, and I mean, I guess, like, kind of looking at my own research and, like, kind of, like, you know, broader readings and things like that, you know, here, you know, I'm in Zambia right now. And this stuff that we're talking about, you know, these aspects of the system is what, you know, I'd say your average person here kind of aspires and wishes that they had around them. Of course, I mean, not to say that, like, you know, everyone's wonderful without it or something like that. There are tons of issues. But yeah, people do wish that there was better internet, that there were more devices, that there was better electricity supply and more power lines running around. So it's a really, I don't know, it's an interesting thing for me to see how this is not just something that we're, like, we coming from the global north are kind of born into, inculcated with, but it's also being sold around the world as the dream, even though at the exact same time, we could clearly point to how messed up it is. But something I would kind of like to ask you about with all this, so what kind of things can we do?
Yeah, I mean, I think the things that you're mentioning are super important. And I think just kind of acknowledging the situation, and I think you restate it really well, that you really restate, like, kind of the development dilemma, like little d development dilemma, that's really serious. And there, this has to be navigated in certain ways for people in their communities. And it's, and you also talk about what Escobar called in like 94, called the developmental dream. And it's ultimately the repackaging and selling of the American dream to the rest of the world in so many words. And like, this is a serious issue. And I think that it's really in this issue of the developmental dilemma that we have to be having these conversations. And obviously, yeah, we're speaking from different places and positionalities, but I think the important thing, and I think why there's so much more possibilities in, say, quote, the global South, is because there's been a less consolidation of these kind of colonial mentalities, even if sometimes they're carried more proudly in areas in the global South than I've ever seen before. But that's to say that, like, okay, like, yeah, having electricity is great. And there's ways to organize and have that electricity that can be less destructive, that can actually be respectful to the environment. But I think a lot of the problem is the way that, yeah, we're addicted and desiring more internet and electricity because we're forfeiting other possibilities and ways of living and being with people around us, also our own environments, and that ultimately we're being structured. And you could even look at this at like almost a type of a slow chemical engineering in humans, in terms of the way that we're actually being kind of introduced to different kind of computational technologies, the way that endorphins are releasing from the brain from emails, the way that certain games do things. It's even with food. There's like a science in terms of junk food, in terms of how chips are going to crunch and make you want to eat more. So I think that we have to actually look at these manipulative social, cultural, and literally psychosocial habits that are being imbued through kind of modernist infrastructures, through different type of logistical systems and things like this. Like, this has to be talked about as a problem, and it has to be talked about as a problem in, quote, global North countries first and foremost, because this is kind of what really kind of spread this colonial and state model that has kind of developed these kind of market practices. So yeah, for me, I think is the biggest dilemma in development. And it always comes out like, oh, you know, who are you to speak about, you know, how someone else should develop and how it is? It's like, no, I'm talking about me, what I see it doing to people around me, and that there's definitely better ways and ideal ways that we could work for together collectively or individually if need be, to actually build more healthier environments and ecosystems. Like, there's ways we can live with the earth again. Like, we don't need to have all this stuff that requires mining, toxic chemicals, and we can find happiness. We can find joy. We can even improve our lives by doing and organizing things differently. And this isn't about telling people how to develop or how to do things. This is about actually doing it ourselves and beginning to do these things, which goes to, I think, more of the point of Chris's question, where there's so many possibilities of what can be done. I'm not going to try to sell some type of model, you know? People have to make this shit themselves. Like, things exist the way they are, usually because of police violence, terrorism, extermination, but also after those waves, the ways that we are super enchanted by capitalism, by junk foods, by technologies, by information communication technologies in general, and the way that the ideologies and the myths that we're told about, if we work, we can have these middle-class lifestyles and step on the people that when you used to get stepped on and whatever. I think you see where I'm going with this. So these solutions have to come from people, and they have to make them themselves. Obviously, solidarity and working with people who see a common interest in doing these things is important. But this is like, okay, if you got a problem with the local politician or governor in your neighborhood, this means deal with it. Organize against it. If you want to organize your energy and infrastructure a certain way, pool the means and resources and do it. And this means actually talking with other people that might want to do that, how to help do this. So I can sit here and tell you, I can give you and be like, oh yeah, if you want to structure and a polity and economy, look at the bioregional model. It's great. It uses Murray Bookchin, radical municipalitarianism, but different economies, it organizes things through bioregions. Ooh la la. You know, I can sell you bioregionalism if you want something more kind of organized of a model to try to apply. If you want to fight stuff, you can look at insurrectionary anarchism and those conversations where people are saying, hey, the more you destroy, the more you save every single day in terms of this and slowing the spread of these things and doing this. So then there's that. You can look into that. You can, if you want to know how to regenerate soil, go look at permaculture. If you want to look at the urban adaptations, they got great urban permaculture textbooks. And now obviously you have tons of indigenous, you know, the Zapatistas who have asked repeatedly, do not treat them like a model to try to replicate, but to fight your struggles and to do those things where you are, you know? And there's so many examples and places, but everywhere is going to have a context. Everywhere is going to have a political history. Everywhere is going to have different privileges and oppressions in different ways. And if there is the common values of, and kind of what the book advocates is, yes, like it's people who are going to have to do this. And it's going to probably have to be decentralized. And that decentralization is going to have to work together with different entities to kind of build this and to actually try to hold in check the different kind of warlords or states or politicians or whatever crazy technology companies that are going to do some weird thing that are going to try to help and sell it a certain way. Like, I guess the short answer is there's a million things to do. Direct democracy, informal organization. There's a lot of ways. And I think we really have to quit thinking in these kind of traditional ways in terms of how we organize ourselves. I don't think engaging in activist bureaucracy or even anarchist bureaucracy and being in meetings all day and doing this, I don't think that's a good way to live. I don't think becoming a bureaucrat, whether as a politician where you get paid inside some weird kind of mechanical state structure, that's horrible. But it's also bad if you're doing this not paid and you just sit in groups and you sit in meetings arguing with people and actually aren't having fun or doing things. So I think the idea is like, how can we actually be showing results and enriching our lives to actually enriching everything around us, including our friends, family, people, rivers, cats, trees, plants, you name it. Like, how can we have more fun and do this better? And it's obviously going to be hard. It's obviously going to have to respect things that you don't like. And it's, yeah, it's hard. It's a struggle. And that's why it's called a struggle. But so, yeah, I guess to kind of sum it up is just to say, I wouldn't actually prescribe any type of model. But there are tons of possibilities and there are very predictable things that states and companies are going to do to try to divide and conquer people to look out for. There's different kind of resources in different areas. And I think the important thing is one, to actually try to connect all these things, kind of quote, connect the crazy anarchists who want to fight or young people who are ready to fight. Like, that's important. Don't shy away from that. Don't cling to some weird moralism. Understand that these structures need to be destroyed and that things need to be defended. But it also means that, say, the more destructive anarchists also lay an important creative side. And that means like really getting into agriculture, different kind of architecture, types of buildings or whatever. And there's also different ways that research can be useful. But I think the thing is actually how the more things are connected, the more people are understanding things and the less siloed and kind of compartmentalized like a cog in a machine people are, the better. So I think on one sense, you know, the more that people are connecting and doing and seeing the importance of these different kind of facets of struggle and trying to kind of develop them in your own life, super important. Know how to garden, know how to support logistics and protests or do more as well as, yeah, on the other side. And I think the second point is to actually don't be reactive dogmatic and to really tactically and strategically look at your resources and what spaces and possibilities are there and to use them. And I think that's one of the kind of the things in the book is just saying like, look, local municipalities can be useful areas. And it's important that actually local politicians or mayors or whatever they are, or different kind of town councils, if they're saying no to these projects that are going to destroy their forests or their rivers and take up their minerals, like this is important. And like that should be worked with. Because they're going to be getting attacked. They're going to be getting all sorts of different pressures in different ways. So like, how do you work with that? How do you use that? How can you build that? How can you build more understanding? This doesn't mean that you don't take a critical eye off them. They might sell out. They might sell you out. You know, there's a lot of ways it can happen, but there are spaces and ways to build things to include people and to try to create something that's nice that people don't want to sell out or don't want to give up. Because a lot of these struggles, or if you're looking at this from a social war perspective, is that the system is doing everything it can to, in military terms, try to demoralize you, to try to break you down, burn you out, really like capitalism and being stuck in your own little cell more than working with other people because of all the interpersonal drama or whatever, you know? So I think it's easy for me to say now, but that's the kind of, I think, the way to conceptualize really, like, how can we actually build things that are fun, supportive, and also effective? And within that effectiveness of making wins or making new gardens or tearing up different paved roads or transforming neighborhoods and engaging in, quote, people's urban renewal, there's a lot of good things.
I appreciate, you know, bringing up the point that it's true, like the system is working to sustain itself. And one of the ways the system does sustain itself is by getting us into our comfortable little cocoon where everything is, quote, fun and easy and soft and sweet. Like, you know, how I feel with my smartphone at the end of a long day, you know, oh, it's my little happy place. Once again, sad, but true. And I think that this is such a pertinent point that, you know, we do have to get out and actually do things and make things in a way that does make it engaging and fun, but not in just a performative way. And this is going back to one of the things that was brought up quite a lot earlier, but this performative activism, like it's so easy to feel like you're doing something when in fact you're really not doing anything at all. Did that make sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. Just like a cat chases its tail, you know, and there's something to it. Is, I mean, a cat chasing its tail or a dog chasing its tail, it has a value. However, it might not be generating the larger social transformations you want to be doing or you're telling yourself you are, you know? And there's been a lot of books and a really good argument to say why do something rather than nothing? And that the more that people are putting their productive energies into this, writing critical academic papers, you're just feeding a machine. You're feeding a publishing conglomerate. The more you're trying to be a social movement bureaucrat, the more that you're just kind of fulfilling a certain type of role that's accounted for. It's in kind of computer science, you're a resistor, you know, that gives feedback to a system so it can keep on plundering and moving and organizing people and resources in a certain type of way. But yeah, I guess it got a little more negative than I wanted to there, but I wanted to support chasing one's tail or intellectual masturbation. There's a value to it, but it has limitations that we should recognize, and it's within a system and a grid that has detrimental effects individually, collectively, and to everything around us. And usually animals, water, ecosystems, trees, indigenous people, black, brown, in that order is going to get hit the hardest and brutalest first. But obviously there's exceptions to the rule, and there's plenty of impoverished white people doing stupid stuff and in serious pain as well.
Absolutely. I mean, it's more the divide and conquer again and again and again and again and again. I mean, you know, something that I really appreciate that you had brought up, like in the introduction, which I mean, we've touched on here a bit already, but that seductive convenience of the system kind of playing into, like, as you brought up from like feminist literature, patriarchy, and how we vote for a politician who, like, even, you know, like a quote unquote leftist politician who says that they're going to do something about this. They're going to fix things. They're going to do right by the environment. And then that's great. We vote for them, and then our responsibility is kind of done. We can go back to the convenience of enjoying all these things of modern world. I've done my part. So yeah, I just really find that such an important thing. And I find that to me, I think that's one of the biggest challenges is getting people outside of that comfort zone.
Definitely. And you just reminded me that, like, one of the key foundations for scientific or modern scientific method is actually divide and conquer an issue to its smallest parts. But yeah, definitely. Chris, Sophia, are you familiar with punk music? You familiar with the Dead Kennedys?
Hello.
Oh, yeah.
Come on.
Absolutely.
Who do you think we are?
Oh, sorry. I assumed a negative on that one. But I don't think Afraid, Give Me Convenience or Give Me Death was one of the kind of the titles of their albums. And I don't think that, I mean, that phrase, among others, haunts me to this day, of that. Because really, when we talk about kind of infrastructural systems, modern technology and all these things, it really is about having these kind of allure and this enchantment and this convenience. But in the end, it's I feel like the more technology and the more digital interfaces, the more my life goes to shit, you know? But yeah, definitely. I mean, just look at ourselves. Like, look, I look at myself. I mean, I'm trying to make active steps to kind of change things one step at a time. And while I've been successful in a lot of aspects of my life, ultimately academia takes up a lot of time. And the more I'm involved in academia, the more I'm like involved in like weird corporate publishers, universities squeezing me, people publishing things that I just think is horrible. And it doesn't feel good. But at the same time, I have a lot to say, and I do enjoy the kind of engaging some of these debates, even though it seems like everyone's just talking past each other constantly, which then makes it super hyper productive in terms of the, like, you've got to like publish a paper in like every individual journal, and there's like hundreds of journals for those like 10 people to actually kind of hear you. So yeah, it's concerning, but hopefully this book, this is an effort to have people kind of understand and see these kind of deeper and more entrenched problems that I think a lot of the listeners and people at Exalt are well aware of. But just the way that, you know, I've spent at least 8 years, 7 years saying that, like, hey, we got to stop using this term renewable energy because it's not true, and it's performing a type of public relations that's extremely misleading with huge social and ecological consequences. And it's just, I see critical researchers and colleagues and friends still using this term where it's just like, man, like, this doesn't exist. And like, this is just because this is the dominant way to talk about it doesn't mean we should keep upholding it. And if we're going to be academics and scholars about it, we should try to be as accurate as we can and not actually have some ambiguous jargon that implies the opposite of what it's actually doing, even if it's a little less bad than, say, hydrocarbon extraction. And again, when I say a little less bad for the unfamiliar readers here, it's to remember that all of those infrastructures that make those things, that run those mines, are using diesel, are using different hydrocarbons, they're using coal to do the smelting. There's so many weird chemicals and manufacturing facilities behind that to even do those types of mining. So yeah, I'd like to see academia at least be a bit more serious about what quote critical means, and to really actually actively try to break with some of the more shitty things in academia. And like, that's the thing. And I do this a lot. I did this with one of my student journals, Debates in Post-Development and Deep Growth Volume 2. It's open access online. Like, me and some of my students and colleagues, we have a whole introduction being like, hey, we're in a university. There's systematically shittier digital interfaces and work being put on us. Like, how can we actually make this better for our work, better for learning, and also less destructive to the environment? Like, how can we actually transform universities to, yeah, start growing food vertically, to become energy self-sufficient, to take kind of responsibility for this type of lifestyle and to make it more fun? And I think there's so many plausible ways to transform a university in terms of like not having six online digital interfaces to like do grading and being able to write and getting better quality of criticism when you're able to actually read it on a piece of paper. And there's so many ways to do this anonymously. It was done for decades, if not half a century or an entire century before this kind of like onslaught of digital systems and technologies. And for people who aren't familiar with it, the amount of energy and clicks that goes into this is ecocidal. And then it makes work and what could be such a fun and amazing job shit. But I think the general moral of the story here is that usually making things better socially can also make things better ecologically. And this is just to stress that these things aren't disconnected and that we really have to reassess the way we're talking about ecological issues and also different infrastructures.
Thank you so much. What good food for thought to close this conversation on. And unfortunately, we do have to close this conversation, even though there's a million things here and a million different threads that we could follow. I have a feeling that we're going to be asking you to come back to the Exalt podcast and be our four-time guest sooner rather than later. So thank you so much for taking time out of your day-to-day, Xander. And we really, really appreciate you sitting down and talking with us.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me. And I just hope wherever we are and whoever's listening, that wherever you are, is to kind of make more space to protect more animals, keep water clean, and to make whatever type of work and conversations we're doing more fun and less destructive and less reliant on crazy digital interfaces.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Xander. It's always such a pleasure. And yeah, we'll definitely have you back on soon. And for everyone at home, please go check out Xander's book. We're going to have a link down in the show notes, I'm sure. But yes, once again, that is This System is Killing Us, Land Grabbing, the Green Economy, and Social Conflict. Thank you so much once again to Xander Dunlap for coming on and giving us a peek into his book, This System is Killing Us. Although we did not explicitly ask the question, a lot of what Xander talked about in the episode are things that we can do in our daily lives. And so this episode, in some ways, is one big answer to the question. A huge thank you once again to Xander. Please join us next month when we're going to be speaking with Ruben Vizzoni about questioning grand narratives of the green transition. From simultaneously the cool, slippery late winter of Helsinki, Finland, and the hot, sunny late summer of Lusaka, Zambia, I am Christopher Shagnon. On behalf of Sophia Hagelani-Albov, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.